So we're hosting two guest speakers tonight, and they're going to outline how they aim to bridge the gap in their respective fields. And in the spirit of knowledge to exchange, we would encourage you to think about what they're saying and think about how that relates to you and how that relates to your field and how you're inspired by that and how you've inspired others as well. And a reminder to tweet, Chantal, to remember to do that. Well, I tweet that, I don't tweet, I don't really know what it means, but I'm sure you will. And I want to introduce our first guest speaker. She's come all the way from Glasgow today. She's doing some tremendous work and been on a tremendous journey leading in our current role in the charity Refugee, Selina Hales. And Selina is going to talk to us tonight about her journey and her experiences. So thank you very much, Selina.
I also have history for being absolutely shocking with clutters and signs. So here we go. I'm Selina, I'm the founder and director of Refugee, and I'm just going to share a bit of where Refugee came from and how it's all come about. Well, the past year and a half has been away from me. So, like I'm sure everybody, I sat in front of TV screens watching images like these, feeling completely overwhelmed and sort of stunned into inaction. With the UN Refugee Summit estimating that 65.3 million people are currently forcibly displaced from their homes, it's pretty easy to understand why we choose to switch the television off rather than do something about it. I was doing that, exactly that, until I caught the end of a news clip about the closure of the Hungarian border, and a father stood with a very small child in a papoose on his front, with the war behind him, fence in front of him, and border control filling that space with tear gas and water cannons. And at that point, I decided that I wanted to do something. I know that I can't change that world, I can't stop those wars, I can't return one of those 65.3 million people to their homes, but I did think I could do something. I believe in the power of community, and I believed in Glasgow. Did I just pass tense that? I still believe in Glasgow. I decided I'd react, I'd do something, I'd use what I had and try and create something. And so Refugee was born. Refugee was about bringing together, I told you I had tangles on slides and they always go nuts. Refugee was about bringing people together and about making sure that we had a welcome for people when they arrived in the city. When I'd seen that father with his child and felt completely overwhelmed, I realised that my previous excuses about volunteering abroad with a young family were exactly that. They were an excuse, and actually there were things I could do locally, there were things I could do here that could have impact and make a difference. So I started to ask people. I asked people I knew, I asked people I didn't know, and I asked them to give me things, to give me donations, to write me letters, to get involved, and gave people in Glasgow a way to respond. After 3 months, I asked my employer for my P45, walked out of my full-time job, and launched myself into this journey. And after 1 month, we had delivered just shy of 100 community-built welcome packs. Those welcome packs have all sorts of different items in them, but we couldn't have got there without our social media. We now distribute about 120 welcome packs per month. My apologies for that flashing behind me, I'm so sorry. I think I've done one presentation about Refugee that is actually not a slide flickering behind me, so I will do my best to keep them back to where they're supposed to be. So I started to share things. I shared pictures, I shared events, I shared experiences, stories. on as many social media platforms as we could possibly remember passwords for. We have Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, and they are always active with events and asks and actions that we want people to carry out. Social media has been really kind to us. It's why I've considered the launch of the project, and once I figured out Twitter and how to be concise, still not really mastered that, I realised just how useful 40 characters was in actually getting to the point and getting people to do things for you. So my hesitation in being so bold as soon as asked was quickly erased when we started the hashtag Twins Without Transport for a recently arrived mum with two very young twins and no buggy to leave her house. As a mum of children, the thought of having one baby without a buggy and trying to leave the house is difficult enough. With twins, I found it completely incomprehensible that we would leave a person in that situation in the first place. But by the next day, we had a double buggy delivered to that mum, and our Twitter has been filled with requests and asks ever since. There are probably 101 strategies that we could use to improve our social media, but I like to think of it as our window, not as a tool to be exploited. We share what we do, and we are open and honest about what we're doing, and I always plan to be a bit more organised and to schedule something that I never quite get around to it. To date, we have now delivered 1,300 welcome packs across Scotland. Those welcome packs contain various items, so they have three types of items. The essential items we put in are toiletries, graphical literature, stationery, and what's not in this picture are hat, scarf and gloves. For about a week of each year, we put sun cream in those packs, but then we return to hat, scarf and gloves. We also always try to get an introduction to Scotland, and it turns out we love nothing more than to stereotype ourselves. So our welcome packs always have Iron Brew in them, again, not in this picture, apologies. Iron Brew, Tannock's tea cakes, lots of tart stuff, and a penny in this one, a lovely Tannock's tea cake penny. The final item, and for me the most important item in our welcome packs, are our letters for the locals. Usually handwritten, personal welcome messages from somebody who is a little bit more familiar with Scotland and the city, passing on their warm welcome and wishes to that individual. We have received, I reckon, just over 5,000 letters for the locals. We have had them from all over the world. We have a PO box and we have post boxes in Oxfam stores, soon to be rolled out across Scotland, at the moment in and around Glasgow. The letters give everybody the opportunity to respond. They open up that act of doing something and getting involved to everybody from all ages. This one, you can read it, it's pretty big. Usually I'm on a tiny screen, so yeah, you can see this lovely one that was passed on to a 4-year-old Syrian boy who kept trying to give us the teddy back because he doesn't understand that that came with the letter. The schools that we engage with have responded phenomenally, with children drawing and writing the most beautiful letters that you can imagine. And teachers have used the letters as a way to get young people to engage in a very different way of forceful displacement. Rarely nowadays do we take the time to sit and think about that individual person who is arriving. When you're writing a letter to somebody, you can't help but think about the person who's going to be reading it. It's a completely different way to engage with the topic. And schools have found it incredibly useful, and we continue to develop a programme that will work alongside the Curriculum for Excellence so that the letter writing and that global citizenship element is built into the curriculum. I've not got anything to say about that this letter, I just included it because it's possibly one of my favourite ones that we've ever had. Especially the week. You kind of have to read out loud for it to make much sense. We receive lots of letters that need quite a bit of interpreting in a totally different way to English, to Arabic or Farsi. From that simple gesture and a heck of a lot to say about it, we have built connections and trust and relationships with the recently arrived community. We've shaped what we do so that we do it with people, not to them. And we like to keep things relative relatively simple, and invite people to come along and join us at things. So this is from an event where we took 14 recently arrived individuals to a gig at Glasgow Barrowlands. We went to see Colonel Mustard and the Dijon 5. If anybody hasn't heard of them, look them up on YouTube. The gig night involved David, a good friend, but from the band, crowd surfing on an inflatable unicorn wearing a disco ball motorcycle helmet, and explaining that to Syrian, Iranian, Sudanese, Somalian individuals was incredibly difficult. We've inspired local songwriters to pen original pieces of music, and in June last year we launched the beautiful album Flight, which you can listen to on our website for free, but then you can download it because you'll be blown away by how beautiful it is. We've won a few awards along the way, but better than that, we used those awards to get some of our volunteers kilted out and in a Scottish dress, and even managed to convince them that they would be perfectly safe to walk through the streets of Glasgow with a knife in their sock. We created a photography exhibition called Claiming Back the Narrative with students from Edinburgh University. This exhibition gave individuals who recently arrived a platform to share their lived experiences living in a new country. It produced beautiful photographs and an awful lot of tears. From the standard dress envelopes that we put in packs, a bit blurry, apologies. From the standard dress envelopes that we put in packs, I definitely forgot to tell you about when I was telling you what was in the packs. We received letters back from the Force Roots Place community. Letters like this one saying, "Hi Ben, how are you? I'm really happy to get your welcome card and the welcome pack from Refugee Jean. I'm so happy to be here because there are people like you to help me. I've left my family, but I think I found a new small family here. Thank you so much. Take care. God bless you. I can't forget this. If any time I look at the pack, I will remember you." I just ruined my ending by that. At some point over the past year, Refugees stopped being I and became we. We are a collective of individuals, of organisations, of volunteers, of refugees, of letter writers, of people. And our actions don't change the world as a whole, but they change people's experience of that world, and that is so powerful. We give people a good place to start from, and whilst I can't begin to imagine, let alone understand what people have been through before they get to Scotland, I do that when you arrive somewhere new, a little gesture, a token of kindness from the existing community goes a long way. Who doesn't like a box of chocolates in a hotel room or a bunch of flowers in a new house? That gesture makes a real impact and difference to people. So whilst we can't arrange that happy fairy tale ending, we're most definitely able to start their story in a warm and welcoming way. And those small actions often have far more impact than you expect. This letter we received back in a pack only a couple of months ago. It fills me with pride, it makes me incredibly happy that somebody took time to say thank you and to say that the welcome meant something, but it also absolutely horrifies me that a bag of toiletries, a book and a hat and gloves generates that response. What sort of world are we currently living in that a bag of toiletries, a hat and a glove generate this sort of response? What we do is just kindness. It's simple, and it's straightforward, and it's what should naturally be happening. After that one, I'm going to leave you on a much more positive note with some final words from Glasgow.
Thank you. You know, it's great to hear good news stories, isn't it? And we hear so much bad press about people coming to countries, the refugee crisis, the wars, the horrific things that are happening, and to hear that kind of humanity and people to people working together is, you know, it doesn't surprise me it's happening in Glasgow, because the banter's always there, isn't it? You get it in Glasgow, wherever you go. And we're going to have some questions and answers later, folks, so we'll keep, if you have questions for Serena, we will have time for that. But we're going to move on to our next guest speaker. And our next guest speaker hails from Dundee, in terms of working in Dundee, and she does some tremendous work as the Chief Executive of Dundee International Women's Centre. And I'd like to introduce Caroline McKenna. Caroline.
So, by show of hands, who here has never been to school? Amina Zubairi was never allowed to go to school. Her brothers were, and her uncles were, but Amina was never allowed because it was too expensive to send all the children to school, so they just sent the males in the family, because the males were the ones who were going to earn the money, and so Amina never got that opportunity. When she moved to Dundee, she had four children, and she was juggling dual societies, dual identities, and living in a family-oriented community is very, very difficult. Anna is illiterate in her first language, so can you imagine the difficulties of learning English when you have never been in the education system, so you don't have any past experiences, you really have nothing to learn. It's extremely difficult. Bakar Salimi. Bakar describes her school as her and her brother were the only brown people in school. They were always different, they were always treated differently, and they were always afraid of what might happen to them at school. When Bakar moved to Dundee with her children, she found it very difficult. Bakar was so lonely that she used to walk across the street and speak to anyone who she thought might strike up a conversation, be that at her children's school or when she went to the shop to buy milk. She was just desperate to have a conversation with someone. And one day, someone did have that conversation and told her about Dundee International Women's Centre, and Bakar's story continues. Narendra is one of our long-standing members. Unfortunately, Narendra passed away earlier this year, and she's one of the most amazing women I've ever met. When Narendra was born, she said that we taught something called hashtag Women of Dundee. And so we put stories up, and this is Narendra's story from her hashtag Women of Dundee story. And when Narendra was born, her aunt told her father to kill her because children, female children, were a liability. Luckily for Narendra, she had the most fantastic father who was really caring and wanted to educate her. And Narendra's father never let her auntie back in the house again, and continued to encourage Narendra to get an education, even though at that time it was very, very unusual for females. And in fact, Narendra was the only lady in her village that was allowed to go on to get an education. Narendra, when she passed away, had a Bachelor of Arts and Bachelor of Law, and she was the first woman in her area to be recognised for that. And there's other difficulties that women that come to Dundee International Women's Centre face. Financial difficulties, and what does that bring with it? It brings with it problems around mental health and general health issues. Bringing up a family living on very little money is extremely difficult. So, how do the IWC deal with social justice? Well, we believe that every woman in our centre deserves equal economic, political and social rights and opportunities. We want a fair opportunity for women to achieve their goals, and we believe that anyone should be able to achieve their dreams. They just need support and opportunity to get on the right path. So our vision is a simple one, and our mission is a powerful one. We promote inclusiveness, we celebrate diversity, a little too much because I used to be size 8, right? But the food that is produced from the women from 80 different countries all fighting to tell us that their mother's recipe is best has produced mass health issues. We create an environment where women can achieve their dreams. And all of our work is based on our core values. And these values were created just recently. The centre is in its 48th year, and we'll be doing big celebrations for the 50th. But the values were created by learners, by staff, by volunteers, by practitioners, by partners, by funders. And we believe that sometimes when doors are closing all over the world, the doors of DIWC are open. One of our key values is around the sense of belonging, so that when women come in the centre, they have that welcome, they feel like they've come home. And it's very difficult to describe. People keep saying, but how do you do that? How do you create that environment? And sometimes a lot of it is intangible and it's difficult to explain. Providing opportunities for women to increase their confidence and to achieve what they want to achieve. I think, like Selena said, we don't tell women what to do. They tell us what they need, and that's really important. So we also work hard to understand what the Scottish Government is doing to support social justice. And we do our very best to highlight and stop illegal acts. So a lot of our women have come up against harmful practices such as female genital mutilation, such as forced marriage and honour-based violence. And those are very, very difficult things to deal with. They are illegal, and we always try to educate women around those issues. But at the core, we are a learning organisation. Our staff, our learners, our volunteers and our board are constantly learning. So what does this mean for Amnath, Vakar and Narendra that you saw earlier? Well, it basically means that they had to learn so much when they came here. They had to learn to be on time, because lots of them are not on time, I have to say. When we start an event or a class at 10 o'clock, it really is half 10. So they had to learn to be on time. They had to learn at home, so they had homework that they had to do. They had to learn from others, which was a new experience. They had to learn to retain information that they otherwise hadn't in the past, and they had to learn to believe in themselves. So we created what we call our learner profiles, and Shameen and Christina here are basically key to all of our work. So whenever we consider an event or a service or a partner comes and wants to work with us, we always consider these individuals. We, as a result of these, we reviewed and revised our customer journey. So when someone came into the centre before, you'd almost think, well, actually, you know, we want to give them a warm welcome. That's basic, you know, basic kindness and customer service. But what happens before? So actually, before someone comes into the women's centre, they might be really nervous. You know, they've never been to the country, they've never been to the centre before. So when they get to the point where they first hear about us, what is their experience? So we've created a virtual tour of the centre and the classes. It's on the website, and that helps people who have never been to the centre before to understand and see firsthand what the centre is like. So that's been really important for us. We also looked at our process around when someone comes in. You know, we don't answer the phone. We speak to the individual that's in front of us. They're the most important person in the room at that time. And it could have taken them weeks and months to pluck up the courage to come into the centre. So we always make sure that experience is a welcoming one. And then as we go through the process and they might come to classes or events or informal groups, that we always make sure that we are asking for feedback. We understand what they like, what they don't like, what they enjoy, what they need more of. And if someone leaves for whatever reason, they could be leaving the country, they might not need the service anymore, we always make sure that that's a positive experience. So these learner profiles have been really important to us in creating our services. We focus 100% on the community and their needs, and we always ask for feedback. You know, how can we help you create a better life for your family? That's one of the questions that we ask. We created services that we feel bridge the gap. There are a mixture of informal learning, formal learning, and events and other things that happen within the centre. There's less structured classes and events, and there's more structured classes and events. One of the key things, though, and this has been really important learning for us, is what happens outside of the classroom. So the classroom structure is there to give people a purpose to come to the centre, but the conversations that happen outside of the classroom are some of the most important. So because a woman has built trust with the staff, she might disclose something that's happening for her in her home life that she wouldn't normally. So, you know, there's obviously we're a women's centre and we want to promote and support gender equality. So if a woman hears from a new friend that she's just met, that actually she doesn't have to not go to IT class because her family said she doesn't, then she might start to question that herself. So we never put that on the women. It's conversations that happen naturally outside the classroom. One of the nurses that came in to do a health check found three women with undiagnosed health conditions. This was all stuff that happened outside the classroom. And consultations by NHS, council, government, we go along and help the nursing and midwifery students, and we do role plays with them so that they can understand and learn more about, you know, women from different cultures and cultural sensibilities. But it's easy for me to stand here and talk and tell you this, but I'd like to introduce you to Dahlia, who's one of our learners who came to the centre, just to tell you her story. So, Dahlia, are you ready to come up? So, Dahlia, do you want to tell us why you ended up in Dundee, why you're here, and about your background?
Welcome, everyone. Really nice to meet everybody and have this opportunity to share my story with everyone. My name is Dahlia Sabih. I am from Mosul, Iraq. I came to Dundee in 2009 with my family, with my husband and three boys. The reason I came to Dundee is like my husband got a scholarship to finish his PhD medicine in primary health care. And for all the family, it was the first experience for us to leave the country and leave Iraq. You know, I don't know, some of you hear the stories and the war in Iraq and what's happening. And for us, it's really difficult to find our way and to just to come here. Finally, we made it, and then we came to Dundee. We found everything is different. The life different, the languages different, people, it's mixed up, like different countries and languages different. And for me, I found myself with my three boys really lonely and desperate and really shy, and I can't speak to anyone at that time. I really feel shy. What I have to say? I just say hi, hello, like, how are you, these kind of things. But I know English, because for me, I studied there and I graduated from University of Mosul as a mechanical engineer. But basically, the basic language in Iraq is Arabic. So we moved on and we tried to settle down. We put my children in nursery and school. And then at that time, I feel more known. I have to do something towards myself. So I tried to push myself to speak to people, know people, friends, people from my country. And all the people, whoever I spoke to them, they just like told me about the community center, learning center, I have to improve my English, I have to attend more courses to know more people. So they advised me to go to the International Women's Center. So at that time, it's really I found to myself, oh, maybe difficult for me because I'm new to the city and I don't know the way, the road, but I managed to find the address and to go to the center. As soon as I get into the center and meet the people in the reception, they welcome me and I explain my story to them. And then they advise me to, or refer me to somebody who could help me. And then, at that time, my life or my journey start. I learn English, I have ESOL qualification from Dundee College, and then I moved on and I've done child care course in the center, the National Progression Award, which the center provides this for the people from ethnic group. And for free, it's really good opportunity for me. I finished my qualification and then I've done my placement in Lysation Child Care Fish in the center. And then I worked a couple of times as a volunteer there and then got opportunity to work in the center. So that's one of the issues that the center provides to the learners. I became from the learners to employer in the center. Because, and that happened in 2012. So I moved on and I work as a childcare support worker in Rise and Shine, work in different areas, different community centers, different places, we provide mobile cash and basically help the mom and children to have opportunity to learn and then the mother keep their children with us to look after them and they're not worried about them. After that, like in 2014, I have to stop working in the center because I need to go back to my country. My husband finished his study. But at that time, we heard the news about our city is taken by ISIS. There is no place to us. There's no way to go back with the three children there. My children, they settled here. They considered Dundee as a heaven for them because they know they are little. My little one is 2 years and a half when we came to this country. But he had the vision, or he can remember, only remember on my country, with a shame, is the war, the bombing, the people killing, and it's not. I say it, yeah, it's easy to say it, but we live there. We know what's happening there. So after that, I left the job, and then we decided to apply for asylum. So we did that, and then I waited a little time. I heard, like, I still contact the people from the center, they still contact me, oh, Dali, what's happening? Are you still in the deal? No, I told them, we are here. We are lucky, to be honest, to have this opportunity to stay here in the city. And then, on October 2014, we granted the asylum, and we moved on. We start, for us, it's different, like, we start from the beginning. We left with nothing. We don't have anything. Like, we don't have country, we don't have place, we don't have like house to walk, yoga, or any place. So we start here, we say, let's start from the beginning. We moved on. Then I just say to myself, why am I not going back to the center again? The people who keep contacting me and then try to help me. So I force myself to get from this zone, like loneliness, depression, kind of, and then start again. So I came back to the center, and then the next people, Caroline, Diana from the center, our manager, fresh manager at that time, Irene, and then they said, yeah, there's your place is there, like waiting for you. Your job is still there. If you feel free to come and join us again, please do. So I start working again in our fish as a support worker. After that, I have opportunity to study more level in childcare, and I get SQ3 qualification in childcare, and I became a healthcare practitioner in Rise and Shine childcare for children in our fish. And since that time, I feel myself. My confidence come back to me, feel more, I believe in myself, I can do something. I help my family, I became a role model for my children, my husband, other ladies from my countries. So So I'm involved more with the center, with all the activities they provided to the learners from different backgrounds. I made more friends and speak to them, listen to their story. I found that there is amazing women inside this center. Meeting people is really nice thing. Hearing about different stories is really nice thing. Make your life easy. Like encourage you to do more and encourage you to help people, because I found myself there in time. Like I need somebody to help me. So the center give me that help, give my confidence back, and we moved on. Like I, you know, more confidence in my work. We expand our work. We work in different places, like we provide mobile education in different places, not in the league, but in Arbroath, Montrose, all over Scotland, and we try our best to expand our like work outside or all over like Scotland. And as I always think, I hope there is like the new International Women's Centre in all over UK, because it's really, it's opened the door for all the people. They knock the door for the center. They feel knackered, they feel like lonely, but as soon as they get in there, it's different. There's different life. It's my, like the International Women's Centre is my second home. Like I found my family, my friends, people who could share my stories with them when I feel down, or you know, I just, there's somebody I could speak to them. Because I don't have anyone here, just only families and friends, no families, just only friends, and they become my family. So yeah, I like my International Women's Center. I encourage people from all over the world, or a student or their family, to come to the center, and there is opportunities waiting for them there. They can do, I managed to do something, they could do something as well. So please, if you feel lonely and desperate, just come to our center. It's really
One very quick funny story, because I know Selena brought up the picture of the apron. So a lot of the women come in and learn English, and so the teachers will teach them that this is an apron, but of course we go in the kitchen with the volunteers who are from Dundee and they call it a peenie, and so they're completely confused and thinking, what is this little apron? So, you know, the staff are real people with a human-centred approach, and we laugh and we work hard and we get upset and we get sad when we hear sad stories of women that come through the centre. But we're very much alive, well and vibrant. This is Diari Drama, who's one of our project leaders. You know, some of the staff are huge role models. Diari got married at the age of 18, her husband lives away, she's got five children, she's done 2 degrees, and she wants to continue to learn more. But we can do more, and we definitely don't get it right all the time. We make mistakes, but we make them quickly, and we learn from them, and we move on. We are looking to be much more transparent about what we do with our money and the impact of our work, and we haven't been as open and honest as I feel we can be, and so that's in the plans for this year. We really want to do more to reach the most socially isolated. We've got a project called Social Isolation, but it's very, very difficult to find, to reach women who don't come to the centre, don't know about us. Really tough. So we've got some big jobs there. And, you know, the University of Dundee, it's about us working together. How can we come together? What can we do? You know, how can we all work in partnership to support the needs of the community? And finally, I just wanted to let you know Anna's story. Anna had this to say: always be all you can be and always remain independent. At the age of 63, I am working towards my dreams of becoming a teacher. Never ever give up learning. My life is now completely fulfilled and I'm a role model for others. And
If I can do this, anyone can. Thank you.
Okay, folks, we're going to move on to some lightning talks, and if you don't know what a lightning talk is, I do know now. It's a 5-minute talk from some of our staff, some people in the field, some people that want to share what they're doing in relation to the research and practice. So we'll have 5 people or groups of people next to come and speak to us, and then following that we'll have a question and answer session. So we'll bring all our speakers, obviously from Caroline, onto the floor, and we'll have an open question and answer discussion. So get your questions ready. But I'd like to, sorry, can you hear me at the back? I've got a big voice. I'd like to introduce first Joanna Maudsley from the V&A in Dundee, who's going to give staff talk with her 5-minute lightning talk. Thanks, Joanna.
Delighted to be part of this event this evening. And just really to introduce the museum, I'm sure everyone is very familiar with the museum. It's very much a visible building now. It's part of the city's 30-year regeneration, and we're kind of just about halfway past that regeneration. Halfway point. And the architect, Ken Okuma, has really designed the building to be what he coins as a living room for the city. So that really kind of underpins the work that we do in our learning and engagement department. We really try and think about this space as being this welcome space for people to come in and access whoever they are, the non-museum goers, everyone and anyone, and that really does underpin our approach to what we do. So just briefly to lift the lid off, if you like, of the museum. You can see in the top left-hand corner there, we've got quite a lot of space dedicated to the learning programme and the kind of public access programme. So a lot of our tours and accessible things for schools and community groups are free. So the museum is free to get in. It is free for community groups to book into the big blockbuster shows, if you like, in advance. So we are really trying to get people into the museum who wouldn't usually come. And then we've got these enormous spaces where we get exhibitions up from V&A London. I can't tell you what they are, I get shocked. So just to give you a little sneak peek inside, some of you may be quite familiar with what the inside is going to look like. A really open, lovely space. We don't know how this is going to be fitted out, but we are consulting with lots of groups around the city to see what they want from this space. And then we'll have dedicated areas that you can actually learn about design in the museum. These will be facilitated by professionals in the field. We'll also have facilities for anyone to come in to use, so families to come in, not necessarily to have to come in and engage with the museum, with the objects, with the exhibitions, but really just use the space as a safe place, a nice place to go and bring the children. And this is our picnic room, so you can come in off the streets, bring your own sandwiches, kind of dining room, and sit in here and just enjoy being in the space. But what I'd like to focus on is just a little bit of a case study that I thought fitted in quite well with the theme of tonight's event. This is quite an unusual object, and when I show it to lots of people, we get all kinds of interesting answers. I don't know if anyone wants to attempt to sort of tell me what this might be, but just shout out.
Shoes.
Shoes, that's good.
Shiwi.
Shiwi. We've had that a few times, actually.
Spoon.
It's a spoon, yeah. So this is a spoon, and this is a guy called Grant. And Grant has got cerebral palsy, so he finds it really difficult to eat his cornflakes, his soup, anything like that without spilling things on the tablecloth. And it was really frustrating him. He was finding it really, really annoying, and it was really knocking his self-esteem. So Grant worked with... Grant was approached by a design company based in Glasgow called 4C Design with this idea. He said, I need something to help me eat my food without spilling it all over the place and making me feel really bad about myself. So basically they used the design process with Grant and the designer to work through the iterative process of lots of different prototypes to come up with the spoon. And you can see here this illustrates how detailed that such a process is to get the right product for the user. It's called the sub spoon, and you can buy them. I think they're about £12. I'm now selling the spoon to him. But they've got a really good website. I would encourage you to have a look at it. It's quite an inspirational story. And it really has transformed Grant's life. And I think that, to me, it's quite a powerful story about what good design can do, and that empathy, that kind of user-centered design. So very briefly, I'm just going to whiz through some slides to talk to you about some of our engagement projects with schools, communities up and down the country, not just in Dundee. This was one of the first projects we did in Dundee back in 2014 called Living Room for the City. So we kind of used Kego Kuma's mantra, if you like, to engage with local communities to design a light, a very simple light for the living room, but just to engage in that idea of co-design and just working together and to just improve the space that you live in, really. We did a national project on this big bus. This is on the Isle of Harris, Lewis, Cowlish Stones, before it really started to rain. And we had 7 Scottish designers on the bus who were all using digital technology to kind of push the boundaries of the work. And we engaged with about 12,000 people nationally during about 5 or 6 months. This was our school's design challenge, and this was a really interesting one because it was kind of based on a model called Design for Change that some of you might know about. It's a program that started in India maybe about 10, 12 years ago. And it was really, it's a program that really gives children and young people the kind of toolkit to make change in their society and their environment and really become agents of change themselves, just by using that kind of design thinking process. There's a problem and I need to solve it, rather than thinking there's a problem, I don't know what to do. So we kind of took that model and did a bit of a pilot with schools in Dundee and Angus, and we kind of set them the challenge, how would you like to improve your school? And we got lots of very interesting responses. But a lot of the responses were about wanting to have a safe place in school, wanting an area where you can make friends easier, wanting to have something that would stop you getting bullied. So it threw up a lot of really, really quite powerful things that the young people were telling us. They were S1, S2, so it was that kind of transition from primary straight into secondary. Then the pupils were then teamed with a designer, the 10 teams that were shortlisted from about 250, and they worked on prototypes on their idea, and then there was a big exhibition in the Overgate Centre. The next one is something that we take out to our family groups around the city. It's a big museum in a book, a big pop-up museum in a book. And basically, we use this to engage families who are maybe a little bit hard to reach or cold to the idea of the museum's not for me. And we just open this book and it's got lots of the objects that pop up, and then we give them a mini kit, but they have to work with each other. So mum, dad, carer, granddad, whoever needs to do it with the child, so they have to do it together, and then they take that away. So it's given them a little bit of an ownership of what the museum can be for them. And then this is a very recent project. This is a very swanky F-type Jaguar. Anyone got one in the audience here? The guy on the right here is Ian Callum. He's the design director of Jaguar, and he's one of our big sort of supporters. And his story is quite inspirational because when he was about 15 or 16, he wrote to Jaguar to ask them basically, how do you become a car designer? He was constantly drawing cars, really interested in that type of feel, but didn't really think it was a real job. And they wrote back to him, they typed him a letter, and they wrote back to him and they said, this is what we need to do, go and study this, and blah, blah, blah. And now he's the design director of Jaguar, which is the most, you know, luxurious car brand in the world. And we launched a project recently to hire students, ask them to design a time capsule for the grounds of the museum. And this is our winner, Louisa Geddes, and she's from the School of Octorada. And she won, her brief, her design won competition. We had about 250 submissions. And Louisa will go down to Jaguar in about 3 weeks' time for a week and see her design being manufactured in Jaguar's facilities in Coventry. So she'll see her design being realised with professionals at such a, you know, such a high level place. So it's a really quite a life changing experience that she's gone through. And I'm really pleased she's a girl, because there was a lot of boys who entered that competition. And then very recently, a really fun project with schools in the Hilltown, working with the Nine Trades of Dundee guys, the bonnet makers. And we really wanted to look at the local heritage, especially in the Hilltown. The street was formerly known as Bonnet Hill, and that's where a lot of the design and the craft and the trade of the traditional bonnets came from. So we worked with the primary four pupils, and they worked with two milliners, and they basically reimagined, redesigned bonnets for the 21st century over quite a long period of time. So they learned the whole process. It wasn't just like a kind of one-off session. And then this culminated in a huge catwalk show in the Wellgate Centre, and all the families and the friends and parents came along and sort of celebrated with them. And then almost at the end, you might have seen there's some work happening in Slessor Gardens. We've got one of the plots, CNA's got a plot there, and it's our community garden project, which was a co-design project with a small group of people who were suffering from mental health problems, isolation, various loneliness. And we managed to get this room together to work with designers to design a garden for the Slessor Garden site. And it's been quite a powerful journey, I think, for a lot of those participants. And they're still involved in the build now. The builders are on site, and the participants go down and check out what's happening. And it was a really nice project in that it gave these people a bit of a voice as well, because they were kind of often left behind. And particularly with regards to what's this museum got to do with me, which we get asked this quite a lot. So this kind of illustrates the kind of things that we can do with our museum. And then to end, I think we kind of say, I know it's a bit corny, but we do say everyone's a designer. We all design things, we all design what we look like every day, but actually really, really good, well-thought user-based design can really change, I think, not only, you know, the wallpaper in your living room, but it can actually change the way we live and the way we think and the way we communicate, the way we act in our communities. So on that note, I'll leave it there.
Okay, folks, now, next I would like to present Professor Divya Jindal-Snape, Professor Bruce Murray from the University of Dundee, and Professor Tina Sonje from the University of Tampere, Finland. I don't know how you're going to do this in 5 minutes. Is it a dance?
Yes. Good afternoon, everyone. You will try to do it in 5 minutes, so keep time. Okay, so what we would like to talk with you about is our shared, we would like to share our lived experience of bridging the gap. And the way we do it, we are focusing on three aspects. One is how we do it across the countries, how we do it across sectors, and how we do it across disciplines. I feel like half of the PowerPoint is gone. So, okay, so we've done a lot of international collaborations where we're doing research with different partners, whether they're university partners or organizations. And these take lots of different forms, and there are different outputs that come out of them, for example, books, but also papers. But we also are working with organizations and, of course, thinking about our students and what we are producing for them based on our work. And along with that, of course, it's very important for us to be thinking about how we're presenting that research, whether we do it as stand-up comedy. Yes, I've had to do that. I've done two rounds of stand-up comedy so far. Or we do it through graphic illustrations and trying to make sure that the research we're doing is accessible, it's reaching, it's making a real difference. So what we are going to talk about today are two projects. One that's happening in collaboration with Philip, with Dina, and it's all the way from Dundee. It's Chris with us. So I'll pass you on to Dina to talk about our research.
Thank you. Our collaboration with DBI and the university is based on the idea that the very important and major and powerful tool for building social justice in the society is school. And for that, we have to do, we have to kind of unite in thinking about how we could make a good school for all. When we research school and study school, we usually do it in sectors. We're looking at the well-being, we're looking at the race and learning, and we're looking at the interaction as separate things. And what we are trying to do, kind of bridging the gap between these sectors of research, we are trying to see the interrelated nature of the school and what's happening there. So the first example of that is the short overview of numerous results that we have been having about learning presented in GPA, so in grades basically. Learning is related to teacher-pupil interaction. It's strongly related to that, so to be able to have those good grades, you have to learn, and to be able to learn, you have to have good teacher-student interaction. And student-pupil interaction is also very strongly related to school-related well-being, which again affects cognitive engagement, learning, and grades. So we have to look at these things together. We can't just look at the grades, so just learning, not just interaction between teachers and students. Then another kind of example of the interrelated nature of these things, from the point of view of a teacher, good quality teacher-pupil interaction seems to very strongly affect teachers' well-being. And that, in turn, affects teachers' ability to learn and develop his work. And again, the teacher feels well, feels inspired, motivated, learns, then it has an effect back to good quality teacher-pupil interaction. So you have to see this as a cycle, good cycle or bad cycle in the first case. So these are just kind of examples of what we're trying to do together. And we're trying to not just do research looking at these interrelated factors. We are also trying to influence on school development in these two countries, at least, for meanwhile. And we're trying to convince the policymakers that we can't, they can't just look at one of those factors. They have to look at the whole working together. Hopefully you get something out of this. This is not my native language, as you realize. Thank you.
So next we are going to move about our comic project.
Hi, I'm Chris Murray, and I'm a professor of comic studies. Before you ask, that is a thing. I am that thing. Comic studies is really a new subject area. So it's a subject area that doesn't really have a disciplinary home. Very many comic studies departments around the world, although there are quite a lot of comic studies scholars. So in its nature as a subject, it's very interdisciplinary. It's always looking to bridge the gap and find partners and wheedle its way in. That the strategy at Dundee, where we're developing comic studies and one of the world leaders in that area, is very much to pursue knowledge exchange and to pursue partnerships. That's very much about industry partnerships. It's about publishers, comic creators, bringing them into discussion with academics, working with charities. We work very closely with the Rand Foundation, and also a number of academic partners. Recently, I've been working with a bunch of Walter Scott scholars, historians and literary experts to produce a comic based on Walter Scott, which is a lot of fun. I've also been working with the Libra Human Centre for Forensic Evidence to produce a comic about forensic evidence and the ways in which it's often misunderstood. It's not like CSI, that's the basics of science fiction. And trying to communicate how forensic evidence actually works in an accessible form, like a comic. One of the most exciting partnerships that I've been involved in recently has been with the School of Education and Social Work, and more specifically with DIFU. We are collaborating on the supervision of two very different and very interdisciplinary PhD projects. We're also working on a couple of research projects, and we've also been working on some comics. One of the things we've been working on recently is a collaboration on a comic about fibromyalgia, which is a neurological condition, bringing together stories of people who are experiencing this this condition with doctors, stories of doctors, stories of patients, bringing them together in a dialogue. There's a quite complex process of creating a comic, from scripts to thumbnail sketches to final draft versions of the artwork, the inks, letters, colouring, and the collaboration that's involved in all those stages and all the different experts and people with different experiences coming together to produce that piece of public engagement and knowledge exchange and work is a hugely fascinating and rewarding piece of work. We've also been working on a comic that is coming out of one of the PhD projects. This is by one of our PhD students, Megan Sinclair, who's studying a new area called graphic medicine, the intersection of comics and medicine, and using comics to communicate medical stories and so on, and information. She met in San Diego a young man. We were over at San Diego Comic Con recruiting, having a lot of fun. She met a young man who was suffering, recently was on the road to recovery from cancer, and suffered throughout his youth. And it was comics that inspired him, and particularly Batman, that inspired him to have courage to face that battle. And because she's doing a PhD about comics and medicine, she struck up a dialogue with him afterwards, and the result was that we turned his story of Batman cancer into a comic, which you can have a look at afterwards, which she helped him write. They worked together on the script. We got an artist based here in Dundee to draw, and that's been a really fascinating way to think about bridging the gap between comics creation, telling stories about medicine, working with medical experts. So comics are really kind of a brilliant way to communicate complex ideas in apparently simple ways. Comics are not simple, but they use iconic imagery, visual metaphor, and an immersive reading experience. And I think over the projects we are working on together, we find that they're a really fascinating way to bring together and engage children, teachers, parents, creators, academics, and all kinds of audiences, and to engage them with these complex ideas. So if you'd like to learn more about what we're doing in this particular aspect of it, you can ask some questions, or we'll be outside and we can perhaps have a little look at some of these things. So come and find us. Thanks.
Did you do it in 5 minutes?
Just about.
No chance.
I didn't believe you did it. Okay, now I want to welcome one of our students, a third year CLD student, Tina Reuter. Hi, welcome Tina. And Tina's going to share some of her experiences with us.
Yes, thank you. So I'm Tina, I'm a third year CLD student, and I'm also a youth worker with Rock Solid, which is a youth project in Douglas area of Dundee. Really haven't spoken in front of a big audience very often, so I'm really sorry if I seem nervous, because I am. In fact, I remember the first time that I'd ever spoken in front of a bigger audience. I was 16 years old, and it was our end of year assignment in arts class in high school to organize an exhibition. So we're given this small budget, a group of seven 16-year-olds, given a small budget, and that was all the guidance we got. So here's a group of 7 young people trying to organize, you know, a venue, pick a theme, select artwork, develop a leaflet, organize refreshments, contact the local press, and so many more tasks that we had no clue of how to do, and we were just thrown into the deep end, had to overcome huge obstacles, made tons of mistakes. I drew the short straw and was selected to be the person to hold my welcome speech. It was about 30 seconds long, and I lost my chance of a million times, but I did it. And as a group, we did it. We managed to pull off this event, and actually, it was amazing. And our teacher was proud, and our families were proud. But us as a group, this group of young people, we were overcome with this sense of achievement, sense of accomplishment, that really we never experienced before. You see, we still lived in this childhood sort of pattern of being told what to do, memorizing what's put in front of you in school, following predetermined steps constantly. And whereas now, for the first time, we had to make our own decisions. We had to discover the steps that we needed to take. We had to learn how to navigate through this real world, but in a safe environment and with support. So I still look back at this experience today, and I think that it did have a huge impact on my future, even if maybe it wasn't as apparent in the moment, because the opportunities rose afterwards that I only took because of the discoveries that I've made about myself during that project, because I learned that maybe I am good at organizing things. Maybe I'm quite a good team player. Maybe I'm all right talking in front of people. The project gave me the confidence, or started giving me the confidence to trust in myself, and confidence is really powerful. So today I'm a youth worker, and I get to work with 16-year-olds every day. And I try to facilitate these same processes, these youth-led processes. For example, at Barsolid, we have this business that is completely managed by young people. It's a social enterprise, and it was set up by a group of 5 young people. They're making arts and crafts, organizing local stalls, and selling their products there. And then the profits they gain from it, they invest into new projects and new ideas. And of course, they're all around the only ones to follow this sort of concept. People all across Scotland, all across Dundee, do amazing work empowering young people to take the lead, to follow their passions, to develop projects and make mistakes, and create learning about themselves and about their strengths, and to develop the confidence to aim high. So because we know the huge impact of youth leadership at Barsolid, we've decided to take things one step forward to develop Dundee's first youth bank. And a youth bank is a youth-led project where young people fundraise together and then decide where the money should be spent on by developing funding priorities. And then the young people develop a process where other young people can have access to that fund to follow their ideas and their passions. And to see where it takes them, it's a grand scheme developed by young people investing in young people. So I suppose to me there's one big difference between a youth bank and other youth-led projects, and that's the ripple effect. Because young people are empowering each other to take the lead, are using their own tools and their own networks to spread this message that you don't have to be an adult to achieve something positive, something great. You can make a difference if you want to. One youth-led project that empowers many young leaders. So today we're talking about bridging the gap, and I suppose there's one message that I'm trying to bring across, and it's this: we can try and build bridges for our young people to make life easier for them because we know how to do it and because we have the tools. Or maybe we can give young people the tools to build the bridges themselves. Thank you.
Good evening. I am going to share my thoughts about bridging the gap from a very different perspective. I have been teaching for 21 years in England as well as in UAE. And first of all, in my understanding, we all are sitting here because we want to bring some kind of change. And we believe that social justice is not just. If you talk about poverty or any kind of barriers or individual rights, policies, social policies, or the educational policies, everywhere, it is not just the politician or the policymakers, not only in the society, have created that kind of injustice, but also in schools. I am currently researching about ability grouping. It is my mental itch which I want to scratch away. I want to know why do we have to divide our children into different groups according to their academic abilities? Because I think every child is unique and every child should be given all types of resources and opportunities to prove themselves. My personal experience is it was an English class where I was teaching. And a child who has recently moved from Spain, whenever it was the time to give out the main activity, she would leave the class. First lesson, second lesson. And I was told by one of my colleagues that they have seen that girl in that time during English lesson just not doing anything, whereas she's asking me to go to the toilet. The third day, when she asked me to go to the toilet, when it was the time to give out the main activity, I asked her to stay back. She did. But later on, when the child told me that she's crying, I took the child out and found out the reason. She told me, I don't want to do the easy work because in the playground then everybody calls me names. And that made me think, that why am I doing it? I am doing it because it's my school's policy. I am doing it because it's a national policy. And that's why I decided to research about this topic. I don't think this is fair to give different kind of activities to the same age group children. Somebody's coloring, somebody's matching the following, just filling the blanks, and some are really doing reading and writing. It really hurts children's self-esteem. And I want to research and find out the reason that what can I do, or what people like me, other social scientists can do to bring the change. In 1930, when this scheme was introduced, it was introduced because it was thought that we should be giving the children the kind of activities or academic opportunities that is suitable to their achievement, which I don't think is fair. After that particular experience, I have decided to not have a group task or differentiation in this way. I do my lesson as a mixed ability. So the high achiever, they work with the low achiever, and I have seen the environment of the class has become very positive. and the kind of bullying behavior in the playground was also almost finished. And if I will go back to the Equality Act, Education Equality Act, this is not what it is. We are not doing what the Act says, that we cannot discriminate with the children on the basis of their belief, their orientation, or their race. But we are doing it according to their academic attainment, which I think is completely not fair. I don't have much to say. All I want to say is that if we really want all of these things to stop, if we really want to bridge any kind of gap, the first thing that we have to do is we have to start from our schools, and we have to stop giving the children very unequal opportunities. They all are unique, and we have to respect their uniqueness. Thank you very much.
Lightning talk presenter, and that's Pete Glenn, who's appointed a colleague of ours in the university, watched across a number of programmes. So,
Jack of all
trades.
Hi, everybody. People who know me will know that trying to get me to speak within a 5-minute limitation and give me a microphone is doubly dangerous. So here we go. When Shan asked me, or I was shortlisted for this event, she said, okay, it's going to be a lightning talk, and it's 5 minutes. I was thinking, well, that's going to be great. I have to be really sharp and really get to the point here. So the title of the paper that I pulled together very quickly is called Increasing Collaborative Energies in Post-Neoliberal Paradigms for Collective Action and a Transformative Global Change. And then I thought again, and I thought, I'll just do a wee ditty, a wee poem, a verse. I changed it to verse because actually poem's quite hard to rhyme with. I was really fortunate today to have 32 people from all around the world. Erasmus Plus people, give us a wave. Erasmus Plus is amazing, and we have 32 people in beautiful sunny Dundee, Scotchio Dundee. It was incredible. This picture shows Dundee with the bridge. The bridge is part of this event. We're talking about bridging the gap. But we were able to go past Desperate Dan, like the comics. We were able to go past youth projects, community projects, and we were able to see Dundee in its splendour. But the best thing about the day was the kind of the dialogue between different cultures, different people. And I think the enjoyment of just having a bit of space to think and to talk, which is great fun. So good that you're all here tonight as well. So my big title has been changed to Pete's Lightning Verse, and I'm going to set the time. Citizens of the world, a big welcome to Dundee. From us here, it's no, put it up, Sam, put it up. There are two activities, by the way. One activity is in the foyer, and you'll see this big mark, and even already today, we've got people who said, I would like to have a placement in Romania. I would like to have a link between Italy and the School of Education, Social Work, and CLB. I would like to have a discussion with colleagues here about partnerships and research. So this map is in the foyer, and when you're having your wine or your soft drink, please add to the map, because people are already adding activities, interests and opportunities that they'd like to connect. There's no point in going to places unless we make connections and we build on this. So please use the map for that. Right, I'll start with this now. I've got another activity that comes at the end of this lightning verse. Citizens of the world, a big welcome to Dundee. From us here at the School of Education, Social Work, and of course, CLD. We know segregation, division, and the culture of others needs to be seriously challenged. We're sisters and brothers. Is my sister up there with I brought her especially so I could go. Bridging the gaps has to be our priority, not colluding with those who blame people for their own poverty. The real stories need to be told, but for that to happen, we need to be bold. M. Faye Dundee, yes, a native from birth, brought up to believe in everyone's worth. Dad in trade unions, mum in the mills, both recognise injustice and society's ills. Growing up at the end of the industrial age, my values, like yours, were formed at an early stage. That power isn't a right. Critical education contributes to the big fight. For justice, we need collective action and we need collaborative might. Chorus. So wherever you're from and whatever your dreams, let's create adventures, bridges and beams. How can we work together, aiming to bridge these gaps? The world's a world that gives chances to everyone. By the way, social justice is very hard to rhyme with. And puts equality and compassion back on the map. Obama said, be the change you want to see. Community is the answer, says Margaret weakly. For Mandela, compassion and freedom for others will help us redress. Freire was for politicisation and pedagogy of the oppressed. But how do we make use of our collective energies? In our lives, in our work, and collaboratively, how do we challenge the them and us? Celebrate and strengthen Erasmus Plus. To me, it's complex, but it's really clear. A lot of people talk about it tonight, actually. But what I've learned over many a year is that tapping into passion, anger, frustration, and desires can be what's really required. Trusting each other to share the questions and the challenges can do a lot less damage. Harnessing our anger and our dreams without fear, connecting these passions with the many, sometimes few. Not long-winded meetings, but actions, things that we can do. So wherever you're from and whatever your dreams, let's create adventures, bridges and beams. How can we work together? How can we bridge the gaps towards a world that gives chances to everyone and puts equality and compassion back in the map? So let's change the world. This is our chance to bridge the gaps and transform lives. What with Trump, Putin and Le Pen, the dangers are rife. Place like in Prague, lightning talks in Lockheed. We can be the change we want to see. With the V&A, with refugees, with DIWC. Research in Rio, seminars in Edinburgh, internships in Italy, and joint visits to Romania. That's what we find out. Social justice and community are the answer. Don't you agree? Don't let our good work go in reverse. This is the point of my lightning verse. And now we're going to do the chorus together. Okay? So after three, one, two, three. So wherever you're from and whatever your dreams, let's create adventures, bridges and beams. How can we work together, aiming to bridge the gaps towards a world that gives chances to everyone? By the way, social justice is back on the right. And puts equality and compassion back on the map. Thank you.